As we noted last week, we are at the very end of the doctrinal section of the Catechism, which uses the Creed to lay out the doctrinal teachings of the Church. And we are in that section where we saw last week we talked about the Church, where we believe in the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints. Now tonight we're going to be talking about Mary, and some of what I'm saying, a lot of what I'm saying, actually extends to the other saints as well. Though I will not be speaking explicitly about all of the other saints. And then finally, next week, we're in the Creed where it says we believe in life everlasting. And so what we're going to be seeing covering next week is our eternal destiny. And it's talking about heaven. And so, but tonight, chapter 12, we are covering Mary, the Church's first and most perfect member. And as I said, this is a perfect week for us to be talking about the Blessed Mother, the week of the Immaculate Conception, and the week of Our Lady of Guadalupe. In the Second Vatican Council, there was a lot of discussion about how the Council Fathers wanted to present the Church's teaching on Mary. And there were many who thought that she should have her own document, a document of the Second Vatican Council explicitly on Mary. But that was not the decision that was made. The decision was that the teaching on Mary would be a chapter in the document which is known as Lumen Gentium, or the Declaration on the Church. And the reasons for that was, some people thought they were kind of dissing Mary by doing that. They were kind of making her secondary in some way. But what the Council Fathers wanted to do was to position the teaching of Mary within the context of ecclesiology, all right, which is the study of the Church. They wanted to make sure that people understood that Mary is not significant by herself. She is significant as the first and most perfect of all of the disciples of Jesus Christ, as the first and the greatest member of the Church. What we're going to see as we go through is that Mary, and this includes Mary's titles, this includes Mary's feasts, this includes the doctrinal statements about Mary, are never really about Mary. Mary never points to herself. She always points either to her son Jesus and tells us through her titles and through her feasts and through her doctrines something about her son Jesus, or she points to the Church, to us, the rest of her children. Like a good mother, Mary's life is never about Mary. Mary is never about Mary. She is always about her children. First of all, her son Jesus, and secondly, about the rest of us. And so that's a pattern that I'm going to be following and trying to make sure as we go through and talk about Mary in a number of different ways that that we understand. Why is it that this is important to us? What is it that this is about? So it places, the council placed Mary specifically within the council's teaching on the Church itself, the identity of the Church, the mission of the Church, the meaning of the Church. Mary is seen as the summation of the Old Testament. She is the fulfillment of everything that the Old Testament was about. She is this woman of Israel, who was a faithful follower of the teachings of the Old Testament, who prayed and worshipped in the synagogue, who lived as this faithful member of the people of Israel, and she represents all of them. Everybody who had come before her, who had waited for and prepared for the coming of the Messiah, she is the summary of all of that. She is the summary of the Old Testament, but she is also the beginning of the New Testament. She is the beginning of the fulfillment of all of those promises. Mary is also seen as the primary image of the Church itself. When we talk about the Church, what gender do we usually use to describe the Church? She. You never hear, we're never talking about, the Church, he this. No. Even though some of the most important images that we use, or archetypes with the church, are actually male. There are three of the apostles who summarize or kind of represent three primary dimensions of the church's life. The first is St. Peter, who represents the whole hierarchical structure, who represents the authority within the church, the institution of the church. There is St. Paul, who represents the missionary energy of the church, the whole missionary purpose of the church, reaching out and going out into the world. And then finally, there is St. John, the beloved disciple, who represents the mystical or the contemplative dimension of the church at prayer, and the church in personal union with God. So we have these three men representing these three primary dimensions of the church, and yet the church is always referred to as she. And Mary, more than anyone else, really encapsulates all of this. She encapsulates the fullness of the church. And so she reveals to us what it means for us to be church. And she reveals to us who we really are to be. All of Mary's privileges, all of it, it points to Jesus and the church. No, Mary is not an accident who just kind of shows up at a certain point in history. She was part of God's plan from the very beginning. She shows up for the first time where? In chapter 3 of Genesis. In chapter 3 of Genesis, we begin to hear about Mary, even though she's not given a name in that passage that I quote all the time, that the church fathers call the Proto-Evangelium, the first proclamation of the gospel, when God is speaking to the serpent and says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. You will strike at his heel, and he will strike at your head. I will put enmity between you and the woman." This woman is going to be Mary. We're going to see Jesus refer to her as woman. And we may even feel shocked when we hear this. When it's the wedding feast of Cana, when she comes and lays before him the needs of the people. They're out of wine. "Woman, what has this to do with me?" This is in the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John, who, by the way, is the one that's going to live with her for the rest of his life, all right? Or at least the rest of her life. And then at the end of that same Gospel, at the scene of the crucifixion, as Jesus is on the cross and he looks down at the foot of the cross, and there is Mary, his mother, and there is also the beloved disciple. And he says, "Woman, behold your son. Son, behold your mother." All right, woman. And then, of course, in the very last book of the Bible, where we see the great conflict going on between good and evil, we see the woman clothed with the sun, who is giving birth to the child. And we see the dragon, the great serpent, who is out to destroy the child. We see the great battle. It is called the woman who is clothed with the sun. Again, the woman. "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers." So from the very earliest moments of human existence, Mary was part of God's plan. As soon as the fall took place and we turned our backs on God and fell from grace, God speaks of this woman and says, "This is not the end of the story. This is not the end of the tale. I will bring about salvation and redemption." So it begins there. It begins there. But then also, as he is working through Israel and the entire Old Testament, because Mary is the summation of that, everything that God does is preparing for Mary. It is getting ready for Mary. I've always been fascinated by the passage in the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah is a very young man who has been chosen by God to be a prophet and to go to the people of Israel and to call them to conversion. Now, God has told Jeremiah, "Oh, by the way, they're not going to listen to you. They're not going to change." And so he's essentially telling Jeremiah, "I'm giving you a job, and you are going to experience nothing except rejection and failure for the rest of your life. How you feel about that?" And he's like, "Please choose somebody else." So he's trying to talk God into choosing someone else. And one of the things he says is, "I'm too young. I'm too young to go. They're not going to listen to me. I'm a kid. And God says, "Say not. that you were too young. And he goes on and says, before I knit you in your mother's womb, I knew you. I already had a plan for you. Before you were even conceived in your mother's womb, I knew who you were, and I had a plan for you. Well, this is also true for Mary. Long before Mary was conceived in the womb of St. Anne, God already knew her and loved her and had a plan for her. But again, Mary is never all about Mary. Mary also reveals to us through that reality that each and every one of us have the same truth about ourselves. Each one of us, before we were knit in our mother's wombs, were known and loved by God and were somehow a part of God's plan. We're part of God's plan. For God, there is no such thing as an unwanted child. There is no such thing as an unplanned child in the heart of God. Every child is wanted, and every child has been planned for, and is an important part of God's work in one way or another. Now, certainly Mary's place within that is going to be unique. That's absolutely true. But each and every one of us have some important role. In the same way that Mary is not a cosmic accident, neither are you or I. We are part and parcel of God's plan. This is part of the tragedy, too, of abortion. First of all, just simply the death of this child. But it is the death of a person who is part of God's plan. God had dreams for that child. In the same way that you, when you have a child, you have great dreams and hopes and plans for that child. God has hopes and dreams for every child. And those who are aborted, that's part of the tragedy. You know, what would they have accomplished? What would they have done if they had been permitted to be born? What would God have been able to do through them if they had been born? And so God has a plan for Mary. And as we learn, she always points to others. So does he have a plan for us. And we're going to understand Mary, the one moment in Mary's life, the one snapshot in Mary's life that is the one that makes all of the difference. It is her fiat. Let it be done unto me according to your word. When the angel Gabriel comes to her, we just heard this the other day at the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, when the angel Gabriel appears to her and says, "Hail, full of grace." And I'm going to talk about that in a little bit too. I'm going to talk about the Immaculate Conception and what this greeting, "Hail, full of grace," is all about. But he greets her, "Hail, full of grace, the Lord is with you." And he then begins to reveal to her that she is going to bear a child, and this child is going to be the Savior. He is going to be the one that God is going to use to redeem Israel. And so she says, "Let it be. Let it be done to me according to your word." Why is this so important? Why is this so important? God has chosen to save human beings, not apart from ourselves, but with us, with our cooperation. Sin required our decision to say no to God. Salvation will require us to say yes to God and to cooperate with God's plan. He comes to Mary. He comes to Mary. The angel Gabriel comes to Mary as God's emissary and says, "Will you do this?" And some of the church fathers, again, in kind of a poetic sense, have portrayed all of this of the angels listening with bated breath. Is she going to say yes? Is she going to say yes? Because she didn't have to say yes. She could have said, "No, this is too much. What you're offering me is far more than I can handle. This sounds really scary. I don't want anything to do with this." And what if she had said no? What if she had said no? As far as we can tell, God didn't have another virgin in the pipeline ready to take this role, right? Ready to somehow step up and do this task. And so she had to say yes, but she didn't have to say yes. She could have said no. Adam and Eve, even though they were immaculately conceived and did not have original sin, chose to sin. Mary could have chosen to sin. She could have said no, and she didn't. And her yes, she speaks for all of humanity. As Adam and Eve, representing all human beings, said no to God, Mary, representing all of us, says yes. Yes, I will cooperate with your plan. Yes, I will cooperate with your grace. And he in our own lives, this again, what does Mary teach us about ourselves? God will not save us in spite of ourselves. He says, will you follow me? Will you follow me? Will you let me save you? Will you cooperate with me in the work of salvation? This is where the whole St. James, when he talks about it, he says, faith without works is dead. Right? To say, oh, I believe God's going to save me. God says, okay, I'll save you, but you've got your part to do. You've got your work to do. Faith without works is dead. You have to be willing to change. You have to be willing to become who I am trying to shape you into. So Mary's yes is our yes, and she shows us what it means to say yes to God. It means not only, oh yeah, Lord, I want you to save me and so I can get into heaven after I die. It is saying, yes, Lord, I will do your will as best I can. I will cooperate with your will. Now, the other day we did celebrate the Feast of the Immaculate Conception of Mary. And of course, what that feast is all about is that Mary was conceived in the womb of her mother, Saint Anne, and that from the moment of her conception to the moment of her death, she never, ever sinned. Again, there are many Catholics. It astounds me almost every year I have somebody come up and say, Father, I always heard that that was about that Mary conceived Jesus without sex. I was like, that is not what it's about. And you were at my Mass last year, so I know this is not the first time that you've ever heard this. This is the first time it ever penetrated. All right? First time you ever heard it, you ever let yourself hear it. But there are many Catholics who still are very confused about what it is that we celebrate on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. We were celebrating that Mary remains sinless throughout her life. How many of you were at my Masses this Monday for the Feast of the Immaculate Conception? Okay, so most of you heard that the way I approached that this year, which was maybe kind of taking a little bit of a different approach to understanding the reality of that feast and what it is that we celebrated. For those of you who were not here, essentially what I was saying was, I just want you to think about someone in your own life who was completely without sin. Who from the moment of their birth, the moment of their conception throughout their life, they never said a bad word, they never had an impure thought, they never done anything wrong. What a goody-goody. Would you want to work with this person? Can you imagine how insufferable that would be? Would you want to live with this person? Would you want to be this person? By itself, the idea, when we think of someone who is just sinless, right, that's a negative. There's nothing there that is all that terribly attractive when we think about that. This is a sinless person. It's almost like a bloodless, lifeless person. The image that I came up with was church lady on steroids, all right? That just taking all of that to an extreme. But the important thing about the Feast of the Immaculate Conception and that Mary was sinless throughout her entire life is that because she was sinless throughout her entire life, she is, as the angel Gabriel said, full of grace. That's what makes Mary beautiful and attractive. It's not merely that she was without sin, but because she was without sin, she was able to be full of grace. And what is grace? And the church talks about two different kinds of grace. It talks about sanctifying grace, which is also called uncreated grace, which is the indwelling of the Holy Trinity, to be filled with God, be filled with God Himself. This is what was lost by the fall. When the fall happened, when Adam and Eve turned their back on God, representing the entire human race, that indwelling of the Holy Trinity was lost. We lost sanctifying grace. This is what we receive in baptism. We are restored to sanctifying grace. This is what is lost if I fall into mortal sin. And it is what is restored when I receive absolution. The indwelling of God. God living within me. That's the first kind of grace. The second kind of grace is called actual grace, or it's also called uncreated grace. Uncreated grace, because it's not the living presence of God. It is something God has created and given to us, and it is spiritual power. It is spiritual energy, right? The capacity to gives us the power to live lives of holiness, to live lives of virtue. And so to say Mary is full of grace is to say, Mary, you are full of God, more so than any other human being besides Jesus, who was God and whose humanity was the great sacrament of God. Mary, when you encountered Mary, that you would have encountered a God woman, a woman who was full of God and who made God present wherever she went. And also, this is a woman who was filled with spiritual power. I talked in my homily the other day about two saints in modern times who I have had the privilege, right, the great honor to actually see flesh in flesh. Pope John Paul II and Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Mother Teresa of Calcutta was when I was in seminary at Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, Maryland. She actually came to our seminary. And she was in our chapel, and we were all gathered there, and she stood before us and spoke to us. This tiny, tiny lady. Right? And she spoke, and everybody was mesmerized. Here was this tiny, tiny woman. And she was the most electrical, most energizing, the most powerful presence I think I had ever seen. As everybody is just fixated on her, the sense of the presence of God that radiated from this woman was incredible. Was incredible. I've never seen anything like what I experienced that day. And also, the first time that I saw Pope John Paul II was while I was in seminary. It was the year after he was elected Pope. He came to the United States, and there was a gathering in Philadelphia for all the priests and the seminarians and the religious of the United States to come there and to meet the new Pope. And so I was up there, and I saw him and again experienced the power that was within this person. This man just, again, how he radiated the sense of strength and power of God, and how this was a man who made God present. Later, I saw him a number of different times. I actually was in Rome for 3 months on a sabbatical 10 years ago. And then the last time I saw him was just about 2 years before he died. It was about in 2004. There were a group of us that did a tour to Rome. Gwen was with that group, and we had a general audience. And he was in a wheelchair at that time, right? And he was rolled out into the general audience, and you were seeing the pictures. It was sad. It was sad just seeing him just kind of slumped, all right? The Parkinson's had so taken away his strength, his physical strength, and he was only able to say a few words, which we really couldn't understand, all right? And usually, you know, when the Pope does the general audiences, they tend to read this sermon, but he wasn't able to do that. So he just read like the first few words, and then somebody else gave that. There still was that sense of God that was in this man, the sense of power that was in this man, even when he had been stripped of all physical strength. When he was stripped of everything human in him, he still continued to radiate God. If we think of someone who is sinless as boring, as uninteresting, these were probably the two least boring and least uninteresting human beings I've ever seen in my entire life. They were two of the most fascinating, incredible human beings because of the work of grace in them. And they were not immaculately conceived. And they were sinful human beings. Can you imagine Mary? Can you imagine how fascinating it would be to be in her presence? Can you imagine the sense of the presence and the power and the compassion and the love of God that would radiate from that woman wherever she was and whatever she did? Can you imagine? Hail, full of grace. Hail, full of grace. But as we look at Mary, again, Mary's presence, Mary's privileges, Mary's, the doctrines about Mary, the feasts about Mary are not about Mary. Mary's Immaculate Conception reveals to us again who this son is that she bore. That because the child that she is going to bear is the Son of God, as the saints have said throughout history, it was entirely fitting that he would be conceived in the body of a woman that had never sinned. Who had never sinned. And so again, through her Immaculate Conception, she reveals to us her son. She points to her son, but she also points to us. She also points to us. It was God's original plan. It was God's original intention that all of us would be immaculately conceived. God's plan when he created us human beings. Now, he knew we were going to mess it up. He knew it wasn't going to happen, but it was still his plan. It was still his intention that we human beings would each and every one of us be immaculately conceived, and that we would live our own lives from the moment of conception to the moment of death, free of all sin. But not just free of all sin, but because we are free of all sin, full of grace. What the angel says of her was what God intended for all of us, to be these blazing furnaces of God's presence and God's love and God's power. Can you imagine us if we had not fallen? The dignity that God had for each and every human being, the sense of purpose, the sense of well-being, the sense of happiness and peace and that God had intended for all of us. This is what was lost. This was what was lost by the fall and what is lost by our own personal sin. So Mary reveals to us what God's original plan was for us. But she also reveals to us what we will be. Now, you and I will never be immaculately conceived. That ship sailed. It's too late. But we will be immaculate again in heaven. We will be made holy when we are in heaven. The journey of holiness, the pilgrimage that we are on, is a journey of growing into holiness, of learning how to allow the grace of God to work in us and to purify us and to make us men and women who are filled with grace, filled with God's power, filled with God's love, filled with God. And in heaven, when we are in heaven, there will be no sin in heaven, and there will be no stain of sin in heaven. We will be, all of us, filled with grace in heaven, and we, like her, our mother, will be blazing furnaces of God's love, of God's presence. That's what God has in store for us. So Mary, again, in her Immaculate Conception, she, as we celebrate this, it is about him, and it is about us, as is everything about Mary, because she's a good mother. Nothing about Mary is about Mary. It's about her children, Jesus and us. Now, one of the things that we certainly do believe is that even though the Feast of the Immaculate Conception is not about the fact that Mary conceived Jesus in her womb without sex, we do believe in the virgin birth. We do believe that Mary did conceive this child in her womb by the grace of God, by the power of the Holy Spirit, and that it was not, as she says, I do not know man. All right? So, that is what we believe. Now, what does it mean for us? What does it mean? It means for us that Mary, in her yes to God, is so complete and so total. Remember, we're going back to her fiat, which is when, at that moment, right? Let it be done to me according to your word. That Mary's yes to God is so complete that she becomes, in fact, the bride of God, the bride of the Spirit, all right? She gives herself completely to him. In the virginal conception of Jesus, there is nothing anti-sexual in that doctrine. All right? That is a distortion that has gotten into the church's teaching, all right? And never in its official teaching, but in the popularized version of this teaching, that Mary, that it would have been unfitting for Jesus to be conceived through sexual union, because somehow sexual union would have taken something away from Mary. It would have made her less pure. It would have made her less holy. That is not our faith whatsoever, which says to us that sexuality is one of God's greatest gifts to us. It is one of the ways in which we are most like God, because we share with God, we participate with God in the great act of creation, of bringing forth new human life, and the incredible exchange of love between husband and wife. All right? So actually, sexuality, according to the teaching of the church, is one of the holiest and most godlike qualities that we as human beings possess. And so Mary's virginal conception is not in any way anti-sex. All it says, what it's saying, is that Mary is the bride. and God is the groom. Looking back into the Old Testament, we look back at the Song of Songs, that great hymn of that great love song between the groom and the bride, and which never actually mentions God, but the church has always seen in that book that it is this is a dialogue between the soul and God, and that the church, again, Mary pointing to the church and Mary representing the church is the bride of Christ. And that we are, each and every one of us, invited into a deep and intense and personal union with God, and union with Christ. So again, Mary reveals who we are to us. Another feast that's coming up of Mary, this is on January 1st, is the Solemnity of Mary, the Mother of God. All right, and this is a feast that flows from an early controversy in the church, trying to figure out, who is this Jesus Christ that we follow? What is it that we really believe about him? Was he really God who became human? Or was he merely a human being who was so God-like and who revealed God to us in the most perfect way that we think of him as God? Or was it that he was so God-like that God adopted him? This was a heresy called adoptionism, that he adopted Jesus, all right, and lifted him up and made him part of the Godhead? Or do we believe that he was truly God, but like in many stories in Roman and Greek mythology where the gods come down to earth and disguise themselves as human beings and walk in our midst, is that what we believe about him? And the church said, no, we don't believe any of those things. We believe that he is truly God and he is truly human. There was also a controversy at the time saying, okay, as they're trying to wrestle with this, what does that mean? What does it mean that he is truly God, he's truly human? This is pretty baffling stuff, right? This is kind of overwhelming stuff. And so they're saying, is he one person, or is he two persons who have been joined together, right? And so is he a divine person, or is he a human person, or is he both? And what the church's definition has come to, and I'm not going to go through the whole, how did they arrive at this, is that Jesus, that there is one divine person who has a human nature and a divine nature, all right? But that Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, all right, this is who Jesus is. This is the person that he is. And he has, as God, he has a divine nature. But also, he became human. Now, he did not become a second person, another person, but this one divine person took on a human nature, a full human nature. That means he has a body, he has a soul, all right? He has all of that. So he is truly, truly human. So the question that was being asked at this time was, who was this child? Who did Mary give birth to? Did she give birth to only the human nature of God, or the human nature of Jesus? And what the church said, well, no, because she gave birth to a single person, and that person is God who has become human. Therefore, she receives the title Mother of God. Now, that does not mean that she predates God, that she pre-exists God. And she does not, obviously. But that the child that she gave birth to in Bethlehem is, in fact, God. And so she receives, this is the greatest of her titles, that she is the Mother of God. In the Eastern world, in the Greek world, the title for this is Theotokos. Theotokos, which means either the God-bearer, or you may have noticed if you've written the chapter where it gives a different definition of that, or translation, which is the birth giver of God. I had never heard that myself before. But the birth giver of God, or the God-bearer. This is who Mary is. Again, pointing to, not herself, this greatest title of all, Mother of God, is not telling us anything really about Mary. It's not really telling us much about Mary whatsoever. But it's telling us very much about who this child is that she gives birth to. Another title of Mary is that she is the mother of the church. And of course, we draw that primarily from the image of the crucifixion, where Jesus is on the cross and Mary and John are at the foot of the cross, and Jesus says, "Woman, behold your son. Son, behold your mother." And the church has always seen in that God is giving Mary to the church to be our mother.